It's Saturday. It's best of the show, best of the week, best of the vault. And I'm going to take you back to Tuesday, where I talk about how perhaps unsettled I've become with the idea of what experts about wars in the Middle East and about Israel's capacities and about Hezbollah's strength, how uneasy I've become trusting them. I do think that they've put forward a lot of incorrect information, maybe based on assumptions, maybe based on what keeps them in good standing in their communities. Actually, in my spiel, don't get into motivation. I'm just looking about what actually happened, which is what we were told about a year ago as Israel was faced with threats, internal, external, existential threats. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, and they combated it with military interventions that we were told couldn't work. They seem to have worked. Now, this doesn't mean that what comes next in a possible escalating war with Iran will be a smart thing or a good thing. I'm just speaking of what has come up until this point. I do think we have to reassess our knowledge of expertise. And then I want to take you back far into the past, an interview that aired on the show in the past about something 100 years ago. And it was the sabotage, a terrorist event in New York Harbor. A man named Michael Kristof strolled into an island in New York Harbor, and he successfully, quote unquote, exploded, well, a stockpile of munitions that were pledged to the Allied powers. Chad Millman was on in 2016 to talk about the detonators, the secret plot to destroy America, and an epic hunt for justice. Enjoy, if you can, that interview and also my spiel about experts in Israel. So we're approaching a major anniversary of a terrorist event in the United States. What? You're saying, oh yeah, I guess it is just about the 15th anniversary of September 11th. Nope, not talking about that. What, a month since the Orlando shooting? Nope. Let's talk about a centennial. You ever hear of the explosion on Black Tom Island in New York Harbor? Well, if you haven't, Chad Millman has written the history of this event that really should be remembered and was quite important and at the very least is a great yarn. It is, in fact, a yarn. The name of Chad's book is The Detonators, The Secret Plot to Destroy America and an Epic Hunt for Justice. Hey, Chad.
How you doing?
So 1916, World War I is raging, but not with the United States involvement. How does that come into play with this cache of munitions on an island in New York Harbor?
Well, I think that's exactly why it comes into play, because at the time, Woodrow Wilson's the president, and he has said the U.S. is going to be neutral. We are not going to join World War I. Meanwhile, American companies continue to build all the munitions they can, and they are selling them to the highest bidders. Mm-hmm. This happens to be the British and the French. The British and the French have a blockade, a naval blockade, so they control the seas. They are the only ones who can get any kind of resources through the blockade. They are the only ones with any money. Germany was so strapped for cash, the Kaiser had declared they couldn't do target practice because they didn't have enough bullets. So the British and the French are buying up all the bullets, all the dynamite, all the shells, and the Germans, who are in the United States, they have a huge spy network in the United States, they see this happening, and they're like, well, we can't buy up any of these munitions, so we're just going to have to blow up the biggest munitions depot in the country to stop it from going and killing our soldiers.
So at this point, the United States had diplomatic relations with Germany. It wasn't even clear, which it was pretty clear that the United States wouldn't join on the side of the Germans, but it wasn't as cut and dried as A, World War II, and B, history might fool us into believing. So when you talk about the spy networks, you know, these included actual German officers who swore fealty to the Kaiser Wilhelm.
Yeah, so there were these massive networks. And what's interesting about this is President Wilson, who sort of had joked that if foreign policy becomes something that is paramount in my administration, something's gone horribly wrong.
Yeah.
Because he didn't believe that when they were neutral, that any country would sort of establish spy networks within another country. And he was horribly wrong about this. So, yeah, all the way up to sort of the highest levels of German diplomacy, they were fully aware that they were operating with phony passport operations. They were planting stories in newspapers. They were paying reporters for excellent publicity and for these stories that tried to raise the flag on sort of what Germany was trying to do during World War I. And all of this was going on under the nose of the American government.
So where is Black Tom Island exactly?
Black Tom
or was?
Black Tom was. It disintegrated in the explosion. Black Tom Island is just on the other side of the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. So if you're at the tip of Manhattan, you're staring at the Statue of Liberty. At her back was Black Tom Island.
And you described this network of spies that was pretty much allowed to take place. But what about the security around the munitions themselves? Capitalistic theory would tell you that the people who controlled these bombs and dynamite and guns would at least guard it competently.
It was incredibly incompetent, actually. It was there were so many rules like they were supposed to follow. The train cars that came in that held all the munitions that were coming in from all over the country, they were supposed to be unloaded every single night so that nobody could sneak onto the yard and sort of detonate a massive explosion. They were supposed to be put in sort of safe zones, or they were supposed to be put in the hulls of the ships that were then heading out to sea. But nobody ever did that. They had, you know, very few guards. And it turns out these guards happened to have been bought and paid for by German spies who were, you know, seeing them walking around and said, hey, let me walk on. I'll give you a few bucks. And like over time, they became known to these people.
So take me to the July 1916 date and what actually lit the spark, which sometimes in history is an analogy. But in this case, this actually happened.
It's very literal. So what had happened was there was a guy named Michael Christoph who had been hired as sort of a patsy, for lack of a better term, by one of the leaders of the German spy network. And he had him working at a factory across from Black Tom Island. So he was very familiar.
On the Jersey side?
On the Jersey side. Yeah. So he was very familiar to the guards who roamed sort of the yard, the railroad yard where Black Tom was. The night of the attack, it was July 29th at about 11:30 in the evening. He walked over to Black Tom and walked right onto the yard, and he was packed with some dynamite. And he had these little glass tubes that German chemists had created that sort of had these natural timing devices. So they put these nickel-sized pieces of metal in the middle of the tube. And on either side of the tube were these chemicals. And the chemicals would eat away at the tube, and then they'd combust when they met. And sort of the thickness of the tube indicated how long before. That was the timing mechanism.
Now, when you say the German chemists had created them, they gave the Americans the technology, and they physically made them in America then and shipped them from Germany.
Oh, no. Some of them they made on sort of docked submarines sort of in international waters.
Wow.
And then they rowed them in. But this particular cache had actually been brought over by an American, a German-American, who was working as a spy for Germany. And he could sort of go free and clear because he was a prominent businessman in the Baltimore area. So he was far away from New York that he wasn't suspect. He had gone to Germany. He had gone to Berlin and had sort of been said, I will help you. And they gave him this cash and he brought it back. And then one of his guys gave it to this patsy named Michael Christoph. So Christoph went on to Black Tom and had his bag full of explosives and put some dynamite in one railroad car and put these little glass cigar tubes into another railroad car. And on July 30th, very early in the morning, around 12:30, 12:45, these two ship captains who happened to be docked in Black Tom Island were talking, and then all of a sudden one of them noticed this massive fire coming out of one of the railroad cars nearby. They realized it was loaded with munitions. They ran for cover, and over the next 2 hours was massive chaos and explosions unlike anyone had ever seen, to the point where shrapnel was tearing into the Statue of Liberty. And that's why years later, Lee Iacocca had to create a campaign to repair the Statue of Liberty because of the shrapnel from Black Tom Island. And all the way into Manhattan, as far away as 42nd Street, the windows in the New York Public Library were being blown out. So the devastation was massive.
Sounds like it worked. It sounds like they had a good theory that once you start exploding some munitions that this will be a chain reaction. But sounds like it worked better than, or at least as good as they could have hoped in their wildest imagination.
Who can say what they were expecting, right?
Yeah.
But what they wanted was to make some noise. And they really wanted to destroy all the munitions they could. And they wanted people to be clear that like something bad was happening, and they felt Americans and American businesses were hypocrites. And whether this was sort of deluded thinking or not, they believed if they could blow up Black Tom Island, the press around it would make people believe that Americans were hypocrites too, because look at all these munitions and they say that they're neutral.
Mm. Were they hoping that it would show German might, that it might put fear in Americans to switch sides?
Actually, no, because they were fearful of the idea that Germany could be blamed.
Mm-hmm.
The case itself was investigated for 20 years after it happened. And for years, Germany's paramount sort of feeling about the explosion was trying to not have to be blamed for it, because they knew sort of the damages it would incur in German-U.S. relations after the war and sort of the money they'd have to pay back. But
so even Weimar Germany was dead set on denying culpability.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which was supposedly Western, well, at least under the heel of the West. So much of your book talks about the quest to crack the case. And I think that you found in those characters some interesting, really, detectives.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were. And they were lawyers, and they were assigned to this case or picked up this case because they kind of thought there'd be a big payday in it, mm-hmm. right? And it turns out that for years they were investigating, and it became sort of this cause that galvanized them. The most interesting guy in the investigation was this guy, John McCloy, who at the time was just a corporate lawyer in New York and was assigned to the case. And because of his experience with the case and investigating Germans, he came to the attention of Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War under FDR. And after the case had ended and the U.S. had finally proven that Germany had done it and they had sort of settled the case, Stimson hired McCloy to be his Assistant Secretary of War because he had such experience sort of dealing with what he perceived to be the devious German mind. And because of that,
You know, you hate to profile a whole country, but, you know, in 1920s, 1930s, not maybe the worst profiling.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, like you're hesitant to say it, but at the time.
Oh, what decade? Yeah. What country?
Exactly.
All right, go ahead.
After the attack on Pearl Harbor, FDR, who had been the Assistant Secretary of the Navy in World War I and had seen very clearly, sort of knew the experience of Black Tom Island and sort of German saboteurs, and then felt he was seeing the next iteration of that with Pearl Harbor, they were deciding to intern the Japanese. And they're sitting in the Oval Office, and FDR looks at McCloy and puts him in charge of interning the Japanese. And he looks at him and says, "We don't want another Black Tom Island."
Yeah.
McCloy ended up going on to become like the first High Commissioner of Germany and the chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank and the Council on Foreign Relations, and, you know, was an advisor to presidents from FDR through the first George Bush.
Yeah. But the difference, aside from the idea of collective punishment, is, well, there are so many differences between the situation with Japanese Americans and German Americans, but there wasn't huge rings of sympathizers in the Japanese community too. Tojo's Japan, for instance.
No.
Yeah. But then again, you could also say that it was clear that Japan was an enemy of the United States at the time of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And like we talked about, it was less clear with the Germans.
But you know what's interesting about that is when Black Tom happened and when World War I began, you know, this was a time of peak immigration in the United States, right? Late 1800s, early 1900s. Everyone is coming through Ellis Island. German Americans were one of the most prominent immigrant groups.
John Jacob Astor, and we're both sports guys, Lou Gehrig, and they all lived in the Yorkville section of New York. And
exactly.
The German immigrants were, you know, the most – many people changed their names, and we don't even know necessarily just by surname who was a German immigrant. But it's still the largest immigrant group in the United States.
And what's interesting about that is at the time, before World War I, there were surveys in newspapers and stuff. German Americans were the most respected of the immigrant groups because they had done the most to assimilate.
Yeah.
And then after World War I began, you saw all of that go away. You know, they started calling hamburgers Liberty sandwiches, right? And they were calling sauerkraut Liberty cabbage. It sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And they had banned the teaching of German in California schools, and they had banned German opera from the Met. And there was a real fear that there was going to be an insurrection of German Americans within the United States if we ended up joining the war. There were stories about that in the newspaper all the time. Mm. Teddy Roosevelt would barnstorm and say, "These hyphenated Americans are going to terrorize us." So it's fascinating sort of how quickly it flipped.
Was there any loss of life on Black Tom Island?
quite a bit. Six known losses of life, including, you know, firemen and policemen who ran in, a baby in Jersey City that was thrown from its crib.
Yeah.
Jersey
City is what, 15 miles away from there?
Jersey City, not even.
Yeah.
Yeah, not even 15 miles.
But a baby thrown from
its crib, right? But what they couldn't calculate was there were massive amounts of immigrants living in boats in the harbor there. Those literally turned to dust, like they just disappeared. So no one's able to really say for sure because there are so many people who weren't documented as citizens of the United States.
We didn't have the word terrorism. Did we have the idea of terrorism back then? Was this seen as something of a separate category than an act of war? You know, how we conceptualize terrorism now.
Well, you know, one of those things that's interesting about this event, and you sort of mentioned it in the beginning that a lot of people don't know about it, right?
Yeah.
There had been 2 years leading up to this of Woodrow Wilson and his aides understanding that there were these massive spy networks in the United States, and there had been incidents of other sort of acts of sabotage at munitions depots. And as soon as it happened, Wilson was so interested in maintaining our neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
He was campaigning at the time as the president who had kept us out of war. The first thing he says the next day, this was nothing but a regrettable incident at a railroad. And even the Bureau of Investigations immediately in the paper the next day said there will be no investigation. This was nothing but an accident. So very quickly, they were trying to walk away from any idea that this was a massive act of sabotage, which is what they would have called it back then instead of terrorism.
Well, maybe it wasn't terrorism. I mean, it was a military target. There was no intention. I mean, if there were casualties along the way, that's fine, but it wasn't an intention to kill civilians. So maybe technically it wasn't. But the other thing is it didn't terrorize us because the authorities downplayed it to the point of ignoring it. And that's why it took 20 years later for these investigators to figure out what actually happened.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the U.S. government definitely tried to sort of say, nothing to see here, let's walk away, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay, but what were the consequences of that? I mean, you could argue that post-September 11th, the world changed and we changed everything. Perhaps we overreacted. I mean, obviously, there's still networks of Al-Qaeda and people who are intent on killing us. And with Germany in World War I, that wasn't their intention. But maybe something could be said for, sure, it was a huge underreaction, but at least it wasn't an overreaction.
Well, I guess you could argue that anything since then is an overreaction, but I don't think that an underreaction ends up being the right solution for something like
that. That's true. When you go there now, is there even a plaque?
Oh, yeah.
What's the there?
So right now it's Liberty State Park. It's sort of at the, I guess, the southern edge of Liberty State Park on the Jersey side of New York Harbor. It's a beautiful
area. Been to the Science Museum with my kids.
The Science Museum is there. It's great. And it's sort of, there's a lovely walking path. You can walk all along sort of the river at that edge of it into the harbor. And there is a plaque. It says, like, it's very small. I read about it in the intro in the book. It's a very small plaque that says this was the site of the first terrorist attack in the United States.
God.
Even that has sort of always struck me in the way it's sort of underplayed. It's like a small plaque, like on a metal stanchion, like covered in plastic. It's kind of fading a little bit. It's not like a metal engraved plaque or anything. But yeah, it's there.
The Detonators, The Secret Plot to Destroy America and an Epic Hunt for Justice. Chad Millman is the author of that book. Thank you, Chad.
Thank you, Mike.
With Iranian missiles having rained down on Israel today, it's a bit too early to know the death toll or the consequences, but minimal seem to be the best guesses. I could be wrong. There could be a tit-for-tat escalation of the type that was avoided in April, regional war. But as you heard Steve Simon on this program yesterday say, Iran had to do something to keep from being humiliated in their region of the world. There is no indication, however, that they or their proxy Hezbollah wants or even can make Israel pay an extremely high price. One question we haven't heard is to question Iranian strategy. Have you picked up on this? I mean, I just questioned Iranian strategy, but I watch a lot of CNN and BBC and read a lot, and it's not framed as confusion or dismissal of Iran's not terribly effective response. It gets treated by the cognoscenti as understandable, proportional, and not raising large strategic questions. It makes no sense to me. As I just said, no one is really sure what the strategy is. It might be that this is just a somewhat humble pinprick of symbolic resistance, and then that seems to be accepted as reasonable. All right, maybe that's the hope of most Western commenters. But then again, if it were a prelude to a wider war, that seems to be taken as not unreasonable, a bit predictable. But either way, the question of Iranian strategy, no matter what it is, seems to have been absorbed among those who analyze strategy. This is entirely the opposite when it comes to Israel. Let's look at Israel's brilliant tactical maneuver of exploding pagers that cost Hezbollah operatives their lives, their limbs, their facial features. Possibly that, plus walkie-talkie explosions, drove key Hezbollah figures together and thus made them ripe for the killing via Israel intelligence and weaponry. Now, of course, the pager attacks did harm some civilians and did reportedly kill a child. But when those acts, which literally blew minds across the Middle East, when they couldn't be diminished as less than effective, they were, among the wise watchers of the Middle East, questioned as tactical, but not strategic. Here was a New York Times headline. Pager attack highlights tension between Israel's technical might and strategic fog. Here's a line from that piece of analysis, not an op-ed, but analysis. To friend and foe alike, Israel appears technologically strong, but strategically lost. That was written on September 19th. 10 days later, Israel killed Ibrahim Akil, the head of the Hezbollah Military Council, along with a dozen other top leaders. 10 days after that, they killed Hassan Nasrallah. And after that happened, after the Nasrallah killing, the New Yorker wrote, quote, "The death of Nasrallah allows Israel to claim a short-term tactical success. Yet, as in the war in Gaza, Israel has not defined a long-term strategy." And here's a quote from the BBC's Jonathan Friedland on the podcast he co-hosts called Unholy.
Tactical mastery. But again, I do ask myself, and I note that you are in a way searching for an answer to this too. What was the strategic goal? And it strikes me that this is something we've been saying about the war itself since October the 7th. What is the larger plan? What is the bigger picture here?
As confused as those Western journalists are, perhaps the supreme, the totems of Western journalism, I'm more confused. I thought killing your enemies, all your enemies, was a strategy. If not a strategy, what is it? Well, before it actually happened, it was written off as a fantasy. Maybe if it wasn't, if someone acknowledged, okay, it's not a fantasy, but what it is then is a death sentence given the arsenal that Hezbollah commanded. But now, U.S. and Israeli officials say that Israel has destroyed half of Hezbollah's arsenal, along with the decapitation we've talked about. And it's more than a decapitation. Israel has achieved a quartering of the limbs and a disembowelment of the guts of Hezbollah. And yes, it is true. It is unbelievably tragic that many innocents have died in this war. A war that all the same sources who I've been quoting and their like-minded peers told us was unwinnable. Don't even think of winning. Israel lost in 2006. Israel's intelligence ineptitude was exposed almost a year ago. The best they could hope for was maybe a ceasefire and that their enemies wouldn't kill too many of their citizens taken hostage. It does seem now that the war was winnable and that Israel's strategy was to win it. And if you need to spell out how were they going to win it, killing the enemy and destroying the capacity for the enemy to harm Israel, that's the strategy. And it does seem that Israel, and not the analysts of Israel and media or government, correctly assess that. Now you can ask, and this is a good question to ask, but at what cost? But when I turn to the answers, I'm beginning to no longer trust the most intelligent Israel observers who I had been trusting to answer the question. You have to admit, even if you grieve for the innocents, which I do, sincerely, even if you worry about fallout, even if you know the history of the Middle East is a history of blowback and unintended consequences, acknowledging all of that, there are no clean victories where you get away and only the good survive and the evil get hurt. That can't possibly happen in the Middle East. And I'm not even speaking of good and evil. I am speaking of the strategic self-interest of all the actors. You have to admit that a lot of the experts have been mostly inexpert. There is no military solution. That had become a mantra, a truism, a kind of creed in the West. And I think more than reality justified it becoming so. Certainly, no military solution seemed a lot more true to the undesperate people of America, the unanguished people in the commentariat who analyze Israel, than it did to Israelis themselves. So I am beginning to question and recalibrate. That is my tactic. That is my strategy. And that's it for today's show. We will talk to you on Monday.